This is a no fun podcast.
Life is miserable.
No fun allowed. Hello, welcome to another episode of The Weeds on the Vox Media Podcast Network. I'm Matthew Iglesias, and joining me today is Herman Lopez, recent star of our opioids episode, and Libby Nelson, who has not been with us for a little while, I think.
Yeah, it's been a little bit. I've been editing, and so I've had nothing interesting to talk about, but here I am.
Well, because we've got, you had a lot of classic Confederate flag content that has become relevant again in a weird way. I want to say at the outset, I would like to talk about the question of Confederate statues, monuments, and sort of, I don't know, historical memory and commemoration. I think that's a intellectually interesting subject. But I also do want to put a pin in the slight bait and switch that's being enacted here, which is that what Donald Trump did at the beginning of the week was suggest that there were a lot of excellent people in a mass demonstration of neo-Nazis and white supremacists, one of whom murdered a counter-protester. He was taking on, rightly, a lot of heat for that statement. I don't think there's a lot of interesting nuance to explore in that question of, like, are some of the neo-Nazis really good guys or not? And to an extent, the whole conversation around Confederate statues represents Trump not apologizing for the more extreme things he said earlier, but simply retreating to this kind of safer terrain, because we've seen at least polls before this topic had gotten aired, there's relatively little mass public support for taking down existing Confederate statues. I think if somebody proposed erecting a new Jefferson Davis statue in a major American city, even in the South, people would say, but there's a strong status quo bias. I think the movement to get rid of these statues is gaining steam, but is not mainstream. So by shifting the conversation there, Trump scores a bit of a win, but also gives us something, you know, worth talking about.
I would say I would not be so quick to say that putting up a new one would not go anywhere. There is a Confederate linked statue in Orange County, California, that has been put up since the year 2000. So people are still putting up these things, or at least we're still putting up these things as of 10, 15 years ago.
Orange County. That's fascinating. So we had a version of this sort of go around with the Confederate flag after Dylann Roof went into that church in South Carolina, killed all those people. And what's interesting is that the polling on the flag is actually quite different from the polling on the statues, which I think suggests that a greater level of public information possibly about this. But you wrote at that time about sort of the history of the Confederate flag in the United States, Libby. And what can you tell us?
Yeah, there's a couple things. One is that I think as a country, we have had a version of this controversy several times over in the past couple of decades. There was the controversy about flying the Confederate flag itself over the South Carolina State House way back 15, 20 years ago. And then after the Charleston church shooting by a white supremacist, there was this sort of larger conversation about Confederate things more broadly, but especially Confederate flags. And at that time, there finally did seem to be this shift to people understanding that Confederate flags were not usually flown since the Civil War, that they were adopted as a symbol of white supremacy, either during Jim Crow or during the Civil Rights Movement. The statues are much the same way. And there was the same argument that people fly and honor the flag for family history reasons. But at that moment, finally, and perhaps because what had happened was so really horrific, the South Carolina flag actually came down. There were actually some changes made here. Not as many, I think, as it seemed the trajectory was going to be at the time. But it is a little bit odd because it feels like as a country, in a way, we just sort of had this like Confederate memorabilia conversation. And here we are again.
I think one thing that's important to remember, too, is that, like, just to explain why it became a controversy a few years ago, it was because a white supremacist, self-declared white supremacist, went to a predominantly black church and killed people. So that made people think, and there were pictures of him posing with a Confederate flag and whatnot. So that made people think, huh, maybe this is, like, a symbol of racism that we should get rid of. But it's it's interesting to me just because it always seems to take some horrible controversy to start discussing about whether these symbols of racism actually should come down.
Well, you know, I mean, part of what happens, though, is that the actions frame the symbols in people's minds, right? It was clear that Dylann Roof did not view the Confederate flag as a kind of apolitical marker of personal background, right? I mean, you see, I mean, I see people who have Irish flag stuff, and that typically does not affiliate them with any kind of viewpoint on something. It's like their family is Irish, right? It's a piece of kitsch. It's not like a unreasonable thing to believe about a flag, right? But like Dylann Roof shooting those people and being in photographs with Confederate flags was a sign of like how this was seen by him. And to me, I mean, that's why this recent march in Richmond has sort of upped the ante around this. That, you know, on the one level, I was saying Trump was trying to retreat from his kind of embrace of neo-Nazism. But on the other hand, we're seeing the alignment of these two issues, right? That there's a lot of Americans, particularly white Southern Americans, who have felt that there should be statues of Robert E. Lee in prominent public places in Virginia. And there's relatively few white Southern Americans who would grab a tiki torch and chant, you know, Jews will not replace us, right? So it's the like closer alignment of the statues with a more aggressive version of the ideology helps people who have always seen the statues in that way see, like, you know, this is what we've been saying the whole time.
Right. I think the context here really is key. There was not like a slow turning away from the Confederate flag, as Nikki Haley, who was then the governor of South Carolina, now the ambassador to the United Nations, said as recently, I think, as when she was running for governor, but it was 5 or 6 years before the Charleston shooting, that, oh, the state's done with that controversy. I think it's time to move on. It really was something so horrific happening that sort of laid bare for many people what the flag had always meant to a lot of African Americans and people outside the South who were pretty clear on what it has meant. And I think to a degree, the same thing is now happening with the statues, because it has been such a week that the actual connection here may have been somewhat lost. But the Unite the Right rally that ended up killing a counter protester, marching around UVA with tiki torches, etc., started out as a rally around a specific statue of Robert E. Lee in a specific park in Charlottesville. And so I think kind of the same thing may be happening here, where the subtext of that message, because of the people who have embraced it and the things they have done, is suddenly becoming much, much harder to ignore for people who otherwise maybe would not have given a lot of thought to it.
And I did think I saw, I believe it was Rich Lowry in National Review wrote over the weekend that he was changing his mind about this specifically because the statues were becoming rallying points for these kind of alt-right demonstrations, right? That if in Germany, the stated reason why there's no marking whatsoever of Hitler's bunker or his birthplace or things like that. I mean, obviously, they were not going to have a like celebration of the life and times of Adolf Hitler. But you might think it would be reasonable to put something there. There's kind of a strip mall and a Chinese restaurant where the bunker was.
That's really interesting.
But there's no signposts, and you have to get like sort of like underground information about where it is if you want to go see it. But it's because they didn't want it to become a sort of even an unofficial shrine, right? So, you know, that's sort of one argument being had here, that, you know, this Charlottesville statue or similar things may not have had they may have just sort of been statues, but if it's going to be the site of Richard Spencer rallies, like, then cities have to act to change. We're sponsored today by Helix Sleep, who really want to help solve a major problem that's out there, which is, you know, night after night, you've got two people laying in the same bed, which is lovely. That's lovely. That's not the problem. But the problem is that when it comes time to buy a mattress, only one of them gets to have their way, right? I mean, you can have people, they could be deeply in love, but still not have the exact same taste in mattress firmness. But until now, Helix Sleep has the solution. They can let you buy a mattress online that's customized for both of you for hundreds of dollars instead of thousands of dollars. If you go to helixsleep.com, you answer a few simple questions based on four key preferences. The result will be a custom sleep profile that's used to build the most comfortable mattress you'll ever sleep on. Your mattress will arrive at your door in about a week. Shipping is completely free. And for couples, Helix customizes each side of the mattress separately, so it's personalized to suit your body rather than your partner's, so each of you gets a great night's sleep. That's why Helix customers report a 30% improvement in overall sleep quality. You have 100 nights to try it out, and if you don't love it, they'll pick it up for free and give you a full refund, no questions asked. Everyone from GQ to Forbes is talking about Helix Sleep, so go to helixsleep.com/weeds and get $50 off your order. That's helixsleep.com/weeds to get $50 off your order. helixsleep.com/weeds.
Maryland's governor, who's now proposing taking down Confederate statues in Maryland. I think it was yesterday that one of the candidates running against him in the next few years, I can't remember the exact year, but he actually, the Maryland's current governor, in the past said that we should put this controversy behind us as well. And like that, where he used almost like Trump's phrasing that, like, what's next? What kind of statues are we going to take down next? Bring down that slippery slope argument. But I think it's interesting to me because I kind of see it as like people just relearning their history in a way, because when these statues went up in the first place, it was during this like very like white backlash to Reconstruction and white backlash to the civil rights movement. Like during the time when they were actually constructed, it was pretty clear what they stood for, that they stood for white supremacy and whatnot. I mean, one of the statues in New Orleans that came down this year was actually celebrating an insurgency in 1874 called the Battle of Liberty Place, I think. And basically this white supremacist group rose up and fought against state, like integrated state militias and police forces. Like that's very clearly a white supremacist cause. And it's sort of like people are relearning that when they see neo-Nazis and the KKK standing by these statues and chanting horrible things.
Well, I would say beyond relearning it, it's probably learning it in the first place. I mean, I think one thing this illustrates is how the Civil War is taught is patchy to bad in a lot of America in terms of what actually happened. How Reconstruction is taught is almost universally atrocious. And I could say that with some confidence because I had a truly excellent AP US history class that mostly has avoided most of these pitfalls that everybody says this history is taught badly. Most of the things I learned about Reconstruction, I learned from like Ta-Nehisi Coates' blog a couple years ago.
Yeah, I mean the Reconstruction point I think is key. My wife is from Texas, and I've heard some entertaining stories about how the Civil War is taught in Texas public schools. I'm from New York. I think the Civil War was taught fine, but sort of between 1865 and 1965. I was kind of taught in a hazy way a sort of vague story of linear progress, right, in which you were aware that there was a civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s to secure more real equality for African American citizens, and you learn that there was a war to secure freedom from slavery, and there's a kind of implication that there's like a dotted line between those two events, like pointing upward, in which there are various milestones of Black achievement, the integration of the armed forces in 1948. The real story is that there was a semi-serious effort at creating civil rights and political equality in the late 1860s and early 1870s, and it was contested with violence by Ku Klux Klan, ex-Confederate generals, many, you know, white Southern civic leaders. And it was successfully contested. And after the, was it 1876 election?
77. Or yes, I do all right. The compromise of 1877.
Yeah. So like the North abandoned efforts to impose, you know, meaningful political rights for African Americans in the South. New white supremacist governments took power, and these statues were put up, the bulk of them were put up in that period as essentially they commemorate the Confederate cause, but they're celebrations of the Redeemer cause, right? It's a signpost that you have overthrown the Reconstruction government is that you can now put up a statue on official government property celebrating the rebel leaders who were defeated 15 years earlier. And like that's what they mean.
Right.
I would say it's also like just underemphasized. I mean, Reconstruction, even if it's taught decently, Reconstruction is such a really key period in the story of race in the U.S., which in so many ways is basically like the story of America. Even it should be taught, I think, is like as important as the Civil War that preceded it. And instead it's like, oh, yeah, I vaguely remember that something happened in 1877 and like set stuff back.
Right. I'm from Ohio and my education was basically totally glossed over this period. Like, we learned a lot about the Civil War, although it was in the states' rights framing and all that nonsense. But one thing that's interesting to me is that, like, when I went to college and I started reading, like, blogs like Ta-Nehisi Coates about this, it was, like, almost like a whiplash experience where, like, suddenly, like, this realization that this wasn't just a normal period in American history where we were, like, trying to heal ourselves a little. This was, like, a violent period when there were like mass lynchings, this real terrorist organization. The first anti-terrorist law was passed to control the KKK. Like, and we just kind of gloss over that in high school. It's very sad to me because like I remember learning about all this and feeling like I was just totally ignorant about this huge period of American history.
And it's interesting, I mean, because a lot of this has been sort of, you know, there's a Southern effort at sort of Confederate memorialization, but also a kind of forgetting and de-emphasis in the North. I live here in D.C., right by Logan Circle, which is a neighborhood, also a literal circle. There's a statue of a guy on a horse. He is John Logan. There's also a Logan Square in Chicago. And he was a Union general, not that significant military figure, but a more important figure in Republican Party politics in the Reconstruction era, a leader of the radical faction, a kind of political boss. He organized Union veterans. Where Logan Circle is now is where the hospital for black soldiers was during the Civil War period. And there was a time when in the North there was emphasis put on commemorating people like that. There are Union Civil War memorials in lots of small towns in New England. But at a certain point, Northern white people stopped really emphasizing that kind of historical legacy. Those kind of figures are not as sort of well known historically. I mean, this, you guys mentioned Ta-Nehisi Coates' blog. He's done a lot of like Ulysses Grant popularization. And, you know, other people have done that too. It was a Gene Smith's biography of Grant that I think sort of got the whole bandwagon rolling on that, but there's been a very sort of real asymmetry to how those commemorations proceeded into the 20th century. So something that's interesting to me here is the kind of slippery slope argument that Trump and others made, because I think this has a lot of purchase to some people, in part because I have heard the reaction of some people. So the way this goes basically is Trump's phrase was like, well, George Washington owned slaves, Thomas Jefferson owned slaves. Are we going to take down their statues too? Somebody said like, well, are we going to not have Columbus Day? And to me, I think the reason this argument has power, right, is that you can definitely find people, particularly like academic liberal historians, who would say, yes, you're right, Donald Trump. White supremacy is inherently bound up with the story of America from the beginning. The United States needs like a real reckoning with its true racial legacy. We should tear down all the statues and all the monuments. We should call it the United States of America. You know, I mean, there's you can go in the realm of like intellectual inquiry. You can go really, really, really far. And there is a certain strain of thought on the American left that simply objects to the project of national mythmaking, right? And when they hear somebody say, oh, Donald Trump isn't the America that I know, they want to tweet like, no, this is how America's always been, you know, kind of
thing.
That's
me.
Right. And then I think that, you know, typical mainstream middle-class white Americans like the idea of American myths. And if you have that sort of polarized debate, incline back toward the Donald Trump view and will say like, oh yeah, like these guys just want to tear down all our symbols because they think Western civilization is fundamentally bankrupt. So let's leave all the statues up.
So I think as you have written here, Matt, like, this is the Confederate statues is a weird point to start having that argument because there actually is a pretty bright line. What's more interesting, and we can probably get into in a bit, which also relates to Charlottesville, is sort of the discussion around Jefferson and how Jefferson is memorialized and remembered. That, I think, really is where sort of the slippery slope concerns begin to kick in.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. I mean, if you look back at previous generations, almost all of them were horrible in some way. And this is why I liked your piece on it. In the end, we try to remember, like, what was good about past historical figures. And, like with George Washington, first president, basically founded the country, like the father of the country. With people like Jefferson Davis and the one in Maryland, Roger B. Taney, who was a Supreme Court justice, I think one of the worst people to ever live. He wrote the Dred Scott decision, which is widely considered the worst Supreme Court decision, and basically argued that black people are of an inferior race and can never be U.S. citizens. So, like, that's what these people are known for. Like, Taney, before that, was an attorney general. He was a legislator. But nobody remembers him for that. They remember him for the Dred Scott decision, which is the worst Supreme Court decision of all time. So that's, like, the important thing is, like, we remember these historical figures for what they did that really made an impact in history. And in the case, these statues, these figures are – they're remembered for essentially trying to defend the institution of slavery and white supremacy.
Yeah, so Yale had a big controversy over the fact that one of their residential colleges is named after John Calhoun.
God, I like blocked this out of my mind, and I wrote about it at length. Yeah. It has been 2 years in America, guys.
Well, so in the wake of this controversy, the president of the university had an interesting idea that he probably should have had at the beginning of the controversy, which was he actually says this, which is that, like, they actually have a lot of smart academics employed at Yale University, and they could convene an interdisciplinary panel with, like, historians, but also sociologists and moral philosophers, and, like, develop a principles-based framework for thinking about this kind of question. I think it's a super interesting document that, you know, provides an interesting framework to look at this thing. And they introduce, like, a few concepts that I would hope to inject into the public debate. One of them is this idea of the principal legacy of the person. So it's like, what are they known for? Like, what's the one line sheet on them? And they make a point that if you excavate historical figures, you can often find unflattering facts about them. They show this. Frederick Douglass has this, like, appalling thing he wrote about Native Americans and how you can, like, easily buy them off with blankets. And so it's nothing like black people who should have equal rights. And, you know, they're saying that, like, okay, but this is not what we – that's an interesting fact about Frederick Douglass, but it's not what we – remember Frederick Douglass for, that his legacy in America is as an abolitionist and a civil rights advocate. The other thing they say you should look at is, what did the people who put this up in the first place, like, what did they think they were doing, right? And that's very relevant with these Confederate monuments. And it's a good question to ask about figures like Taney and figures, especially figures like Jefferson, who have genuinely ambiguous kind of political legacies, right? It's like, we can – I don't actually know, like, who put the Jefferson Memorial up on the Mall and, like
– FDR.
For what purpose?
I'm almost certain. You know, I should look this fact up before we go any further.
And then the other thing they say is that you should ask, what was the debate at the time of their life like, right? So that, you know, it's one thing to say, well, you know – there's a sense that people are a person of their times, right? And it would not be extraordinary for a 19th century American to espouse some racist opinions. But obviously, there was a large civil war about whether slavery should continue to exist. So you can't merely write off Robert E. Lee's views on slavery as like, well, that's what everybody thought at that time. Like, there was a huge war. They're talking about Calhoun, and they're saying, you know, as the strikes against him, really the only thing he's known for is his sort of partisan leadership of the Southern cause, that cause was very controversial at the time. It's why he was a partisan leader. The one mark you can put in its favor is they do sort of archival work, like, why was that named Calhoun College? And it was basically they were like rummaging through the Yale alumni list to find people who had been prominent politicians.
Oh, I know that guy's name. All right.
And he was, in fact, a prominent politician. But there was no evidence that this was like intended as like a fuck you to black people in Connecticut or.
That's not like a super compelling reason to keep it on there, especially since presumably since then they have had many more prominent even prominent politicians.
I agree. But I mean, I think it speaks to the question of Tawney, right? That you could imagine, this is not the situation in Maryland, but an exhibit somewhere that just has statues of all the chief justices.
Right, exactly.
Right, and then you wouldn't, it would be an interesting kind of claim to say, well, okay, we're going to decide this one chief justice was like really bad, and so we're going to tear him down, right? That would be a sort of a misunderstanding, whereas a single statue of the guy at the Maryland courthouse is like, rah, 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 you know, cheerleading, right? Right. So to me, that's like an interesting kind of point. And it puts the Confederate leaders in an almost uniquely bad spot, right? The whole point of Robert E. Lee is that he was a Confederate military leader. The whole point of the war is that this was a controversial question at the time. And we know these statues were put up to celebrate political triumph against the local black population. And that, to me, seems really different from, like, taking an excessively rosy view of George Washington or something.
Yeah, I think there is a split here. There's a reason that, like, all your faves are problematic is a thing that is said on the internet. Like, by 2017 standards, even among contemporary people, it is very hard to find someone who checks every single box of perfect progressive opinions that in like no way will our descendants be ashamed of us in any way for. But there are a lot of like objectively better things that people have done than solely be famous for starting a war against the United States to preserve slavery.
Right. I agree with that. It's just like, to me, it's just when we think of Thomas Jefferson and George Washington, it again goes back to that point. Like, we think about the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution. We think about Washington heroically enforcing an alcohol tax, which we need more of in the U.S.
Yes, that's all. That's what we all think of.
But yeah, with Robert E. Lee, I honestly like struggle to think of anything else except just that he was a Confederate general. That's it that comes to mind. And I like to think I've looked at this historical stuff in detail.
Well, my favorite Pro Lee narrative is that actually he hated slavery and didn't want it to continue, which like, sir, you made some mistakes if that was your goal.
This episode is brought to you by Parachute. Parachute does not make parachutes. Instead, what they make is really soft, really comfortable sheets, the softest, most comfortable that you are ever going to own. They sent a set to me, and they are just really great. I could not be more pleased with just the sort of texture and feel of the material that they sent. And the quality, it's immediately noticeable. They're made in a family-owned factory in Portugal. And the reason the sheets are so great is that they're made from the best materials. They've got 100% long staple Egyptian cotton, and the sheets last. And with well-made sheets like Parachute makes, what you find is that, you know, after more washing and more use, they get softer and better and more comfortable over time. So, you know, they are really confident in this product. If you go to parachutehome.com/weeds, you will get free shipping and you will get free returns on your order with a 60-night trial. You know, they believe that if you get these sheets, you are going to love them. So there's no problem with the free shipping and taking them back. So if you don't love them, send them back. But I don't think you're going to want to send them back. They don't think you're going to want to send them back either. You're not going to want to go another another night without your parachute sheets. So just visit parachutehome.com/weeds for free shipping and returns on the softest, most comfortable sheets you'll ever own. I tweeted yesterday that I had been a little surprised when I saw the public opinion polls on this, which were very strong, 60 to 70% support for keeping statues up. And I said, look, you know, a majority of people favor these statues and a large one, and we're going to have to like convince them and not just yell at them. So that got a lot of people yelling at me on the internet. But I think I really do stand by that. I think it's unconstructive to look at a poll like that and decide, okay, 60 to 70% of the population are like hardcore ideological neo-Confederates who believe that we should be celebrating a violent rebellion launched on behalf of slavery. I think it's clear that this is not relevant to most people's daily lives, not something that there's like a ton of thinking about or engagement with. And I've been taken aback by the amount of email that I got from people very seriously telling me that the Civil War had nothing to do with slavery. And I think sort of like ideologically advanced progressive people can sometimes forget that, like, if you're going to complain on Monday about the sort of successful, you know, historical whitewashing campaign, you then need to remember on Tuesday that like lots of people are going to assume that what they were taught in school is accurate, and you can't cast like heaps of aspersions on them for sort of accepting things as they've seen them. It's crazy to me that like you would think that a war that was obviously about slavery was not about slavery, but like that's in a lot of school curricula.
It's pervasively taught, and it is. I learned it in eighth grade, and it makes you feel super smart when it's like, actually, the thing you think the Civil War was about was not the thing the Civil War was about when you're like 12.
And that's in Kansas?
That was in Kansas, which like the one thing you learn in Kansas history was that Kansas was like on the side of the light, and we were a free state, and people snuck across from Missouri for freedom, and like we were the good guys in the Civil War. So like it's the textbook thing and the curriculum thing do not follow regional boundaries in the way that you would necessarily
say. So, I mean, because so in Kansas, I mean, did they teach you in school like about leading Kansas?
And yes. Yes.
And that conflict was about slavery.
Yes. But the thing is, Kansas history was taught in like fourth grade, and then U.S. history was taught in eighth grade. And it's very sort of dependent. I mean, we had a very like triumph of America. The two things I learned about the Reconstruction then that I can still recall were scalawags and carpetbaggers. I do not think we learned the word redeemers. Like, I think the good thing in this scenario, though, is like, I assume we are not going to get an act of Congress or an executive order taking down all Confederate statues. And to a degree, this really is like, I think there is a good place for local politics as a way to like have these conversations, do this research, convince people on an actual local level of this. I also think because like this is not an issue that affects people's lives significantly, there is a place for elite leading of opinion on this. And that's where we saw, like, that's kind of what we saw in South Carolina with all of a sudden, like, everybody, many, many influential people changed their minds. The flag came down.
Yeah, that actually doesn't surprise you that, like, how you learned it in Kansas, because I'm trying to think back of like how I was taught it, and it's very similar. You go through like the 1840s and 1850s really learning about the escalation of slavery, but then in 1860 it's like almost they start doing this like whiplash or transition to, but it was states' rights.
But tariffs.
But tariffs, but trade, and all this other stuff. And it's like, it just glosses over that, like, the central issue in at the center of all of this, that the state right that states were specifically fighting for was the right to keep slaves. It's like a very smooth transition. You see it in some of these history classes, so it doesn't really surprise me.
You know, an interesting sort of historiographical note on this that I think sometimes people lose sight of today is that a big part of the reason the sort of history of the Civil War got rewritten that way was the activities of sort of Southerners, white supremacists, people on the right. But there was also in the beginning of the 20th century a kind of left movement to do that, right? That there's a strain of kind of left-wing thinking about the world in general and America in particular that wants to sort of say that everything is really about economics, right? And to deny the sort of centrality of race and of racial events. And so you have this sort of fact that the Republican Party in the 1860s was very much the party of big business and of northern industrialists. And to sort of construct a kind of like pat quasi-Marxist interpretation of American history, it then has to be that that party wasn't authentically opposing human slavery, right? Because it doesn't work out right. Now, interestingly, that wasn't Karl Marx's view. He was alive at the time. He wrote a kind of famous letter to Abraham Lincoln about how, Union victory would be the first blow in the war for the working class. He had his own take on, you know, the dialectic, I guess, and this. But that was part of the reason for it. And we see kind of small echoes of that controversy on the leftward side of the political spectrum, you know, down and down to this day, is like, is everything that happens in politics in some sense really about class conflict? In which case you have to dig through and say, well, this war was really about tariffs. It was about railroad construction. It can't be that people were just like having a disagreement about race and identity, and that actually drove political outcomes.
I think that's true, but I also think that's based on a sort of broader misunderstanding of slavery and how it worked that sort of underpins this whole debate. Like, it's insane to say that slavery isn't about economics. It was the entire economic life of the South rested on owning people and not having to pay them. Picking cotton was difficult and expensive. I mean, I think this is certainly in the sort of elementary, middle grade, lesser class high school history that we're talking about, this is a problem, but also sort of in the broader American sense of like, you learn that slavery was a bad thing and like a morally terrible thing, and therefore conflicts about it were moral conflicts. But like, it's not like a separate Venn diagram of like slavery and economic issues. Like, those things are really tied up together. And so that's when I think when you get to like, oh, it was about states' rights, like, I'm not a confrontational enough person to do this with random people in public, but I really want to just like keep poking them and be like, states' rights to do what? Like, what is the right that they wanted that they didn't have? Oh, it was slavery. Oh, okay.
Right. I mean, I also get all those emails that you mentioned, Matt, and it always blows my mind. I mean, some of the like theories that people have for why the Civil War started are like really interesting, in that they're just complete. They have no foundation in anything that you would look like. If you look back at when the states like actually wrote their like were seceding and whatnot, they were very clear about what they were doing. A lot of them said explicitly this was about preserving slavery. And people just seem to look at those kinds of documents and just completely gloss over them, like treat them as irrelevant, even though they are literally why states said they were leaving the Union.
Right. And to Libby's point, I mean, recent books by Sven Beckert's book, Empire of Cotton, and Edward Baptist's book, The Half Has Never Been Told, are both sort of efforts to show how slavery worked as an economic institution, right? That it wasn't just a kind of a free-floating, like, off-the-axis moral controversy, but that, you know, this was deeply embedded in the Southern, but also the global economy, and that there was, these sort of fascinating connections between derivatives trading and Northern industrialism. And there's an interesting kind of dispute between historians who look at this period and economists who look at the question of slavery, where there's I think the historian's viewpoint is that if you look at the actual sequence of events that actually occurred, slavery and slave labor were integral to the development of the actual institutions that happened. Whereas economists look at the very sudden demise of American slavery is a good sort of economic test of things. And it turns out that as it happens, when you couldn't use slave labor to produce cotton, the economic system adjusted sort of rather quickly and easily to a whole other regions, because the war completely shut off Southern cotton exports. So one kind of spin on this that you get is like, well, it's like slave labor built global capitalism. And then another line you get on it is like, no, it turns out that slavery was this moral abomination that was also totally unnecessary, and they got on fine without it. And I think both sides in that argument think that their way of viewing it, you know, like proves the better moral point, and they get very angry at each other about this kind of thing. But I mean, it goes to show that, right, there's no, this was the critical economic institution of the South. There would be no way you could have a giant debate about the nature of the national economic system without it also in some way being a debate about the slave system. And so, you know, the notion of there being something else there, it doesn't really make sense.
I think what I'm realizing is we need some great national popular culture about Reconstruction. Perhaps the Grant biography will be adapted as the Hamilton biography was before that. And I say that like only semi-jokingly, because I learned a lot about the Revolutionary era that I did not know from the like year and a half of Hamilton mania.
Yeah, I mean,
it was not like a period I was particularly interested in. I now know the names and facts of a lot of things that I did not know about before.
Yeah, I think if people just learn about what happened after the Civil War, like during Reconstruction and after Reconstruction and the backlash to that, I mean, it's not only that it would teach people like, hey, America has this really dark history that like you shouldn't have been glossed over in your high school history class, but was, but also just puts a lot of the other issues that we're like dealing with today in like a better context, shows that this is like centuries of buildup. Like it's sort of weird in history classes how this is taught, because like you suddenly just like it almost is like you see the civil rights movement pop up out of nowhere, whereas like no, there was this like century of like serious white supremacist KKK suppression during this period, and like that's what slowly led to the buildup of this. But the way that it's taught in history classes, it's almost abrupt. Like Jim Crow just came out of nowhere, and then the civil rights movement popped up.
And you know, I will say one reason that I really like don't want the slope to slip here is that to Libby's point about the Hamilton musical. I mean, I read a lot of like bitter, angry, lefty think pieces on Hamilton with basically like, actually, Hamilton is bad. This got tied up a little bit in Bernie versus Hillary kind of land.
Shocking. No conflict has ever boiled down to that in the long run.
And 100% of the things that Alexander Hamilton's left-wing critics say are correct. And I still think it's this really stupid viewpoint that like people, a country, particularly a country like the United States, that attempts to like transcend blood and soil nationalism and stitch people together on the basis of abstract and sort of bloodless ideals needs a pantheon of national heroes to make that a little more real to people and their lives. And it's important, obviously, to have like accurate history. It would be terrible if what the Hamilton musical did was portray Alexander Hamilton as being correct that America should have an elected monarch.
Right.
But it doesn't do that. Like what it actually does is it does some violence to the actual specific history to make Hamilton into purely an icon of modernization and sort of inclusive vision of America, which he sort of was. But I mean, they create a heroic Hamilton, just like I think there's nothing wrong with having a heroic view of George Washington rather than a like the Washington DC is where it is in part because of like a shady land deal that he pulled off. But like, you know, okay, he was president. He could have been a dictator, but he decided not to be. Good for him. Good for us. I said that it was a Gene Edward Smith biography of Grant that had, I thought, start this in motion. But Ron Chernow, who wrote the Hamilton biography, he has a Grant biography coming out this fall. So maybe there will be a musical. And you know,
I've had a lot of jokes about this, but I actually am beginning to think this is a good idea. Like having added a myth to the backdrop of American patriotic myth is like not a small achievement. Like that's a major thing to have done.
Yeah, and I think that kind of myth making, you know, when done well, or at least appropriately to the times, is good. It's constructive. I mean, it's not the same as like getting your PhD in history. But, you know, normal people, I don't know. I think we need our heroes and illusions in America. Okay, if you enjoy listening to The Weeds on your phone or at your computer through your headphones, something like that, you're going to really love sitting in chairs and watching us talk live. We are bringing The Weeds to the Now Hear This podcast festival in New York City this September. I'm going to be there with Sarah Cliff and Dara Lind putting on a great show. And there's a whole great lineup at this festival. Love It or Leave It, Larry Wilmore's Black on the Air, Politically Reactive, and The Crack podcast, plus a whole bunch of other favorites from Gimlet, Public Radio, Earwolf, Radiotopia, all the sort of big podcasting networks. It is a great value if you're a fan of podcasts. One ticket gets you access to all 25 live shows throughout the weekend, and the first 100 people to use offer code WEEDS at checkout save $20. So Now Hear This is September 8th through 10th in New York City. Come see great podcasts, meet the hosts, and make some new friends. We would particularly love to see fans of The Weeds come out there. I would like to see you there. So go to nowhearthisfest.com to get your ticket. That's nowhearthisfest.com, and enter offer code WEEDS at checkout to save $20. I'm really hoping to see a bunch of you there.
This is Todd Vanderwerf. I am here with a listening recommendation for you. It's my podcast, I Think You're Interesting. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people who are shaping arts and entertainment, culture, and the media. Names you might know, names you might not know. Some of our recent guests have included Academy Award-winning documentarian Errol Morris, David Lowery, director of A Ghost Story, and some of my favorite film critics discussing their favorite summer movies of the 21st century. You can find I Think You're Interesting on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
One other thing I wanted to touch on here is that one of the talking points against removing these Confederate statues and the flag and whatnot is that it's historical erasure. And just one thing about this is that, like, these cities and states that are considering this, they're not just throwing the statues in the garbage. A lot of them are putting them in museums. Like, New Orleans has been actively looking for people to take its Confederate monuments. The Confederate flag was moved to a museum after it was taken down in South Carolina. So, like, I mean, when it goes in a museum, that's definitely not erasing history. That's where, like, a lot of historical stuff resides. So it's just important to emphasize that, because I think a lot of people think that these statues are just being totally destroyed, and that's part of it. And that's just not the case.
Yeah, when I was in Budapest in June, and they have, this is not a perfect historical parallel, but they have a park of when the Iron Curtain fell and the Soviets retreated from Hungary. They took all of the, like, Soviet realism 14-foot tall statues of honoring the workers and the leaders of the state and whatnot, and put them in this, like, super barren, super weird park on the outskirts of town. And it's, I do not think that would work in America, A, because we would probably need, like, a small state to fit all of the Confederate statues in, and B, the risk of it becoming, like, a Confederate theme park would be extremely high. It even has a little bit of that in Budapest. But it was a really interesting, like, that is a country, and I think a lot of Eastern Europe after the fall of the Soviet Union sort of did have this conversation of, like, what do we do with all of this stuff that commemorates a period in history that we, like, maybe don't want to commemorate? I think there's, you know, there are examples of, like, people, America is not the first country to ever have had this problem. There are examples of how people deal with this.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously there's a range of different things, right? I mean, if you have a road that's called Jefferson Davis Highway, you can, I think, just rename it. I mean, that sort of is erasing the history of the road, but also who cares? Whereas, yeah, I mean, you know, monumental statues, you shouldn't just, like, put in the garbage can somewhere. You should do something. You know, I would even say battlefields, right? I mean, we have preserved historical battlefields. That seems like an appropriate place for, like, statuary of the relevant military figures can be appropriately, hopefully the whole battlefield is appropriately contextualized for people to explain what it is. One point that I do sort of have mixed feelings about that Ross Douthat mentioned the other day is monuments not to, like, the hero on horseback, but to the rank and file soldiers, which I have not seen figure quite as prominently in these arguments because they're sort of not the biggest, the most visible ones. But I don't know. I don't have, like, a super strong feeling about this, but I can certainly sympathize with the view that, you know, a community is entitled to sort of mourn the dead. You're talking about, you know, the motivations of ordinary soldiers in any conflict are interesting, but at least conventionally, we don't say that, like, everyone who fought in the German army is a Nazi per se, that, like, what you do, particularly when there's conscription, as there was in the Civil War, is, like, people do what the government tells them to do. On the other hand, that's actually not, like, a great lesson.
Yeah, I think this is one where the fact that it is a civil war becomes, like, this is probably a really obvious point, but it's extremely difficult. Like, we don't go around, like, ranking – well, we do go around ranking wars, but we're not like, oh, well, we're going to, like, take down this memorial because it was a bad – like, it was a bad and stupid war for bad and stupid reasons. I do think the complexion of that, or the sort of the valence of that, changes a bit when it's like, yes, like, two-thirds of this community is honoring an ancestor who died in a war that wasn't their choice or their fault. But to the other third of the community, that's a symbol of a war that was fought to make them not count as human beings. Like, that's right. I don't know what to say. Like, that's really hard. I don't know.
Yeah, I think one thing too is that with some of the discussion, like, going back to, like, the historical erasure thing, is that if we actually took down all these statues of Robert E. Lee, we would not suddenly forget who Robert E. Lee is. There are plenty of, like, books, like, history books with his name in them. But when it comes to, like, these soldiers, these Confederate soldiers, in some cases, these monuments may be the only place where, like, their names are actually listed and people can think, like, hey, that was my ancestor. And, like, I might not agree with what he did, but he fought because the government told him to. And, like, I don't know, I want to honor my ancestor in this way. And I think that's, like, an important difference with this is, like, we actually don't need some of these monuments to know history. But with these Confederate soldiers, there actually is, like, a possibility that these people would be completely erased if those monuments were not.
Yeah. A flip side of that is that, you know, about 100,000 African-American Southerners ended up fighting in the Union Army. I'm not sure how many white Southerners did, although I know from Tennessee, Kentucky, from the border states, at least, there was a fair number of white soldiers.
Maryland. We looked this up on Maryland earlier this week. Yeah.
And they are largely uncommemorated. I happen to live near the African American Civil War Memorial in Washington, so I have. But
that's, like, so said on the Metro that, like, hearing those words in context is weird. It's just, like, a thing that they, like, I do too, and it does not, like, unless I'm there looking at it, it just is, like, a collection of words. Anyway, sorry.
But there are not a lot of those.
No.
Certainly not in southern cities, right? I mean, and I think I would be inclined to say, like, keep memorials to common soldiers on the Confederate side, but create ones for soldiers on the Union side. I mean, I feel like that is the statement of political community, right, that has always been lacking, is the idea that the Black people who lived in Georgia, who worked there as slaves, who fled the plantations, who fought in the Union Army, who participated in the Reconstruction governments, that those people are authentic members of Georgia's political community, right? And erecting, not to single out Georgia, but, you know, erecting monuments to Confederate political and military leaders while having none to people who fought for the actual government of the United States of America and for political ideals that we would embrace today is a way of saying that, no, the real political community down here is just the white people, right? And that is what makes this completely different, I think, from questions that are just about, well, how do we evaluate this historical figure? It's a statement always about, like, what is Virginia? Right. Like, who counts for real here? And when you're saying there's a statue for Robert E. Lee and there's a highway for Jefferson Davis, who's not even Virginian, but there's nothing for Black soldiers who fought to save the country, you're saying that the Black people don't count as real members of the community. And that is what fundamentally has to change. And I think that creating new things as well as tearing down old ones is integral to that.
One thing that's important here is that, like, stating just why these statues, a lot of people feel these statues need to come down in the first place, is, like, racial reconciliation, which we have never really had in the U.S. And one way I think about this is that there are still monuments in the South. They might not explicitly commemorate this, but they're like monuments at the sites of where, like, actual lynchings happened, like really bad lynchings. And I remember a report, I can't remember the organization that put this out, that they found a bunch of monuments dedicated to these sites where lynchings happened, but none were in the South were commemorating like the victims and like remembering who these people were. And that's like one small way that the US could actually look back at this horrible period in its history and like think and try to like make amends is by focusing on the victims here. And it really has not done that. And I think that kind of speaks to like some of the Black Union soldiers as well, is that they were really like fighting for their most basic rights. And we really don't remember them as much as we should. They had like the most running on this war. Like this was their basic human decency being considered here. And it's just tragic that we don't honor them.
There are occasionally interesting stories about sort of lone quixotic hero endeavors to like set up museums or memorials to lynchings or to slavery or to sort of hidden parts of the civil rights movement in the South that are a huge part of that region's history, but as Herman was saying, like are not commemorated in any way. While there's like a plantation you can visit, you know, in on every corner. And if anyone's listening who has been like looking around for a historical cause to endow, those efforts to me they're profiled occasionally, and they're always really interesting as just a reminder of like, for all of the fetishizing and celebration of Civil War history, and we have just finished the sesquicentennial of the Civil War, there is so little attention paid to really other crucial and important history in that region.
Yeah, and with that, I think we're about out of time. But while you're paying attention to crucial and important history, undertake the crucial and important task of rating this podcast on iTunes, recommending it to your friends. Also listening to the other Vox Media Network shows. Worldly, I think you're interesting. They're all fantastic. Join the discussion in the Facebook group. I'm particularly interested in hearing what people think about sort of rank and file soldiers and how to commemorate them. Thanks to all of you for listening. Thanks to Bert Pinkerton for producing, Riyadh Shawi, our engineer, and we will see you next week.